He knows that the Germany that he has constructed faces one big problem. And what's the big problem for Germany geopolitically? Two fronts. You have to avoid fighting on a two-front war. Right? Now Bismarck, blood and iron, he's not blood and guts. You know, our blood is guts, right? That's what the 442nd said about this son of a bitch who kept sending him into these horrible woods, the Japanese. Our blood, his guts, right? Well, he wasn't that kind of a leader. Right? He was sound in this sense. And when he put Germany together, he said, we are, Deutschland ist satt. Satt, S-A-T-T. Right? Satisfied. Full. After you've had a big meal, and Bismarck had lots of them, you're sopped. All right. We don't need to mess around down in the Balkans, and we don't need territories in France, in Africa. And we don't have to have colonies in the Far East. Right? We're sopped. That was Bismarck's position. So he maintained a European order this way, with France isolated. And Britain sort of over here and messing around with its empire, let them do that. We're sat here. And we'll keep this secret agreement with Russia to make sure that we never have to fight on the two-front. So, you know, Bismarck is not representative of this world political aggression. You may say Bismarck's a big, you know, German pig and he used war to establish Germany, and there is blood and iron involved. But it's not, he doesn't turn that into a general geopolitical aggressive position. So you can only go so far in associating Bismarck with this sort of general notion of German expansionism in the 19th century. That begins when Wilhelm, this pen's gone, of course, Wilhelm comes in. And he and his crew have not liked this restrained version of Germany. And they want to expand. They want to give Germany its place in the sun, expand its markets, expand its colonies. France has colonies, Great Britain has colonies, why can't we have colonies? Right? And one of these things that we really don't like is that non-aggression pact with Russia. Right? We don't need that. We're tough. Right? And you know, whatever Orlo says about the specifics and their decision making on that, of course, is to be taken seriously. But in general, the notion is, well, we could handle a two-front war. I mean, that's the implication of that decision. The implication of that is we could handle a two-front war if we have to. Right? Now, that may not have been what they're thinking, but by letting that thing lapse, that's the result. France, then, establishes a steps in there and establishes a diplomatic relationship with Russia and indeed signs a defensive pact with them. Okay, so that's what really changes the whole balance of power in Europe, that decision right there. Because now you've got France and Russia, Germany's in the middle. Britain's still over here, and Orlo explained this in some detail. But gradually, because it originally had closer relations with Germany, and that has to do with the families and so on, connected the royal families, and Britain and Germans didn't see, you know, themselves as fundamental enemies. And this is going to carry itself forth. And Hitler makes some very strange strategic decisions with regard to Dunkirk, for instance, okay, and sort of waiting things out until this bastard Churchill comes up, and he sees Churchill as just the enemy, because he thought he could work with the British, and he did not perceive Britain as a natural enemy of Germany. So there are a few spots where this stuff really gets in the way of his brain, right, with the, you know, in terms of this racial view of things. You know, one has to do with the development of atomic power and atomic weaponry. You know, anti-Semitic bullshit got in the way of the Germans getting the bomb. They could have had the bomb years before we did, if they hadn't seen that as Jewish science. And, so that would float up. And then also, he could have knocked Britain out of the war. Boom. That would have been it at Dunkirk. He said he hesitated because he felt that there was a certain connection between Germany and Great Britain. So that's sort of a long-term effect of that. But between 1892 and 14, as Orlov says, Britain starts to develop stronger relationships with France and with Russia. Okay, and so you have the development of, during this period, the Triple Entente, Great Britain, France, and Russia, against the Triple Alliance, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. Okay. So that's where things stand in August of 1914, when the assassination takes place in Sarajevo. And from that point on, it's actually pretty simple. Okay, Austro-Hungary has issues down in Serbia and Bosnia. And in 1908, they've actually, you know, gone in there and imposed their rule a little bit more intensively on the Serbians. And there are plenty of nationalistic movements in the Balkan region that could have triggered this. It happened to be some Bosnians who were in Sarajevo who assassinated the Archduke. Okay. Now, just a quick aside, Bismarck had didn't give a hoot about the Balkans. But he knew that it was a possible place of trouble. He said, some damn thing in the Balkans is going to trigger something. That's what he called it, some damn thing in the Balkans. But he said, the Balkans, there's no aspect of the Balkans that is worth the life of one German soldier. Not one German soldier should be lost in that effort. So he didn't care about the Balkans. But when Austro-Hungary attempts to impose its authority on Serbia after the assassination of the Archduke, okay, it makes almost impossible demands on the Serbians. And the Serbians tried to comply. They really made an effort to comply with everything. But he wanted to be able to send Austro-Hungarian officials down to do the investigation of the killing. And that was, you know, that's just an incursion into their sovereignty. So on the basis of national honor and international law, they just, as the one point they balked on. So Austro-Hungary really pushed things to the point of war. Austro-Hungary wanted more. Right, so if there's any instigator, it was Austria-Hungary in the First World War. Now Germany backs Austria-Hungary. Because it's in this triple alliance with them. This is the mistake, if you will, that Wilhelm II makes. They didn't initiate things here, and they didn't push things the way the Austrians did, but they backed the Austrians. And they said, okay, we'll honor our alliance with you. If you push things, we'll honor that. Okay, and that's known as roughly the notion of giving Austria a blank check. That you can pursue whatever interests you want down here and we'll back you up. Now, there are some details to how this all unfolds, and there's some indication that when Wilhelm gave that order, he hesitated. He was scared. He knew what the stakes were. Right? And he hesitated, and he prevaricated a little bit, and then the order was sent out by telegram, and he actually reversed his opinion and panicked and said, no, we can't do it, and tried to recall it, but modern technology outstripped him, right? The telegram was sent, there was nothing more that could be done. It's like sending an email, oh, right? Can I get it back? Is there any way? No, it's gone, right? You send it on email. So always sleep on an email, and always sleep on a telegram that's going to start the First World War, right? Okay. Well, meanwhile, the Serbs, a Slavic independence movement against those Austrians, right? They have the support of Russia. So Russia backs the Serbs. Germany backs the Austrians. Okay. Russia is backed by France. Great Britain officially didn't know what it was going to do. Okay? It didn't give clear indications to the Germans where they were going to go, if they were going to enter into the war or not. And if the British made a mistake, and this is what Germans will argue, it was that they prevaricated, that they didn't give a clear indication one way or the other, so it was reasonable for Germany to think that they weren't going to have the British involved. Okay. But in the end, they had these secret treaties with France, and they had an open treaty with Belgium. When the Schlieffen Plan, which we'll talk about in a minute, when the Schlieffen Plan trigger kicks in, Germany invades through the along the English Channel, which we'll talk about in a minute, and goes through Belgian territory. And when it does that, that gave Britain the public reason for them to enter the war. And that's when they come in. And Germans, maybe to this day, they're probably pretty old, but will say that was perfidious Albion. Right? We didn't know what they were going to do. And then they jumped into the war at this late point, right, in the diplomatic game. And so, you know, that's what really skewed things. You can blame us for doing it, but these decisions were made without a clear indication of what Britain was going to do. So I'm just sort of spelling these things out because it's sort of, these are the issues that are involved in the question of war guilt. You know, who's really guilty here? And did Germany deserve to have the war guilt clause? Not that we care about that because it's diplomatic history. I mean, that's just information, it's data, it happened, dun, 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 dun. I'm not so concerned with that. But because an issue of war guilt has tremendous symbolic value. Right? These things become, each of these elements contributes to the notion of, you know, German identity, and especially after the war. So it becomes part of the mythology of the war, how it unfolded, how it broke out. And did we deserve to have the war guilt clause thrown upon us, imposed upon us in the Versailles Treaty? And should we have been responsible for ultimately paying all the costs of the war and the penalties of the war, which they were? Right? So this is, I'm just trying to sort of present it, not from a German perspective, but how these things feed into this that whole issue of myth of German war guilt.
Was the Schlieffen Plan this like Bismarck callback, or was that
Wilhelm? No, we'll have to look at Orlo to see when Schlieffen put that plan together.
Okay.
But let's turn to that in just a sec. Okay. So that's how the dominoes fell. Right. Austro-Hungary, Serbia, Russia backs Serbia, Germany backs Austro-Hungary, France backs Russia, Great Britain comes in because of Belgium, France, and also because of Russia. So boom, that's how all of them get sucked in into that process. Because of this this treaty system. Okay, now let's talk about what happened for a little while. My pen is blood red, that's good, but it's very faint, so we'll see if we can get it to work. Now, I'm doing this for the First World War, but I won't do this even this much for the Second World War. Because, you know, the Second World War, we have a, you know, there's plenty of information out there. And most of you are generally familiar with how the Second World War unfolded. The First World War is kind of forgotten because it's been overshadowed, at least in popular culture, by the Second World War. And, but that's a mistake, because it's really the First World War that starts all of it. You don't have the Second World War without the First World War. You need to have a sense of how this unfolded. And because the mythology of the First World War, the imagery of the First World War, not what happened, but the ideas about what happened in the First World War are so important in the interwar periods. So important, not just to the rise of National Socialism, but to European life as a whole. It just has an immeasurable impact on the way people perceive, especially politically, but socially as well. And even in terms of language and linguistics and the way you think about yourself, a lot of studies have shown how language from the First World War, attitudes from the First World War, notions of you know, the position of the individual soldier vis-a-vis the enemy before them and the bureaucratic enemy behind them, the sense of isolation of the individual is all intensified by the experience of the war. And it, you know, we can see it in popular novels, in popular language. We use First World War language now. To this day, you may not even know it. Undermining is one example, and I'm probably not even going to be able to come up with others right now. But it is part of our language, and we forget the origin. But especially for understanding the tensions that exist in German life, a lot of them in the interwar period range around how the experience of the First World War was to be processed. Okay? We're going to look at Remarque to get one side of this, but there are certainly other sides, and we'll use Remarque as a way to get into that. So, just a little explanation for why I am going to actually draw a kind of a map here and talk a little bit about unfolding the First World War. It's not that difficult. But this is the Schlieffen Plan. Sorry for the cough. Now, in 1870, the Germans attacked directly westward, and they broke through at Sedan, which is in the region that is sort of where Verdun is, and they drove right over to Paris. Okay, so it was more linear. In the interim period, and we have to look at Orlow to find exactly who this von Schlieffen was and when he came up with this plan, but noting mechanized war and perhaps the impossibility of that, or coming up with something different that would be safer, Schlieffen came up with a plan that would be a way, and I guess this is really the issue. You can fight a head-on war with France and it can drag itself out if you're only going to fight against France or only going to fight in the West. But if you're going to fight a two-front war, you got to think about it differently. You got to come up with a way to knock France and Britain out as quickly as possible, right? And then get ready for the onslaught of all those Slavs coming out of Russia. Now, you're going to have time because those Slavs are a little bit slow, and they don't have the trains, and they don't have the mechanization that the West does. So you can buy a little time, or you can use a little time up in the West and then get ready for the East. But that's the idea. You got to knock German and the French out quickly. Now, how are you going to knock out the French quickly? Well, the assumption is that the French are going to defend along that line and advance directly eastward. Okay. So they're going this way. They expect you to come this way. Right? We're going to wheel around them. We're going to go through Holland and then through Belgium and into northern France, and we're going to do this big wheeling move. Right? They're going this way. We're just going to come right around them as they do that. Yep. Is there another marker there? Excellent. Thank you. Okay. So here's Paris, and here's the western most part of France, and they're going to either go this way, they're going to go this way, and we're going to wheel through this way. And what Schlieffen says is that the last German soldier in the row should dip his cap into the English Channel as he swings around. Right, so you want to go as close to the water as possible and envelop the whole of the French army that way. And it was important that the army go outside of Paris, envelop Paris, because this is where the French had their reserves. So you're going to envelop the whole army. Okay. Well, what happened is that the Belgians resisted more intensively than the Germans planned, and the Russians mobilized more quickly than the Germans planned. Okay. So they panicked a bit. And they probably didn't go as far north as they expected, and they didn't go as far west as they planned. They came in short of Paris. Okay? And then took place what's known as the First Battle of the Marne, which is a river outside of Paris. And the French had their reserves, and they were able to throw their reserves, and it's very famous, because they rode out there in cabs and in bicycles and whatever it took to get their reserves out there. And they held. They were able to stop the Germans at the First Battle of the Marne. The Second Battle of the Marne is not until 4 years later in the last offensive. And they got that far and they petered out again. So it's going to take 4 years for the Second Battle of the Marne. The Germans retreat to a better defensive position, and then what starts is called the race to the sea, and they try to outflank each other, and neither is able to outflank the other. Okay? And the result is the development of these defensive lines. They tried the same thing through the south, and within a few weeks in 1914, before Christmas, you have these two defensive lines dug in that run from the English Channel and Belgium and France, French border all the way down to the Alps. And the line did not change for 4 years. Significant. For 4 years, Germany, France, England, Austria slogged out, just pounding each other along these lines. With, you know, shifts of no more than a mile here, 5 miles there at any particular time. No one was able to break through. Now, looking back retroactively, the lessons learned were developed in what the Germans called Blitzkrieg. And what Blitzkrieg is the use of mechanized trucks, trains if you can, motorcycles, and planes to pierce through a point on the line in a very narrow space. It might even just be the space of a road. You know, 50 feet is all you need. But if you've got mechanized high-speed troops, you pump them through that hole as fast as you can, right? You break through, and then you envelop the other troops. And in 1940, when they go through and just, you know, wipe the French out, that's what they do. They just hit with these mechanized divisions, get through with tanks, trucks, automobiles, motorcycles and Stukas, right, through on a very narrow, but you can get enough troops through very quickly using those machines to do it. Well, they weren't thinking that way in 1914 yet. And they didn't think that way from 1914 through 1918, and the result was slaughter. Because they still thought about advancing on wide fronts, maybe 10 miles wide, okay? So you have hundreds of thousands of men advancing on these wide fronts, and the idea was to break through on a wide front. And then you'd envelop. This is where Napoleonic notions of how you fight a battle met modern technology. And the high commands just didn't get it. But whatever. They just had an advance to the point, and they didn't have the tanks, and they didn't have planes, and they didn't have the machines that were necessary to do that blitzkrieg approach. So, be that as it may, what happens is you have this consistent use of the same strategy for 4 years, and that is to bombard a sector in the line in order to eliminate the defenses there, to eliminate the trench workings, to eliminate the barbed wire, and to break down the artillery backing and so on. And this shelling would take place for days at a time, a week, 10 days, whatever. And then at an appointed time, the shelling would either lift or it would start to move forward. They would have it creep forward. And synchronized with that, those troops that had been set there and had been settled in and waiting for that barrage to end would come out and go over the top and advance across a wide front that way. And it all seems, you know, maybe logical, but it never worked. Never worked. No one broke through. So what you had is 60,000, 100,000 men walking out, and the defensive positions were always stronger than the shelling. Either they withstood the shelling, or they just had pulled back and waited the shelling out, and then they moved forward and started firing on the rows of these men coming out of their cover. And the results were catastrophe. Over and over and over and over again.
Now, these are not just German deaths, but it wasn't just in a German affair either. Let me read a little bit. This is written by Paul Fussell, whose great book about the First World War and its cultural impact is called The Great War and Modern Memory. And if you watched any of the Ked Burns, he's one of the young infantry that's talking about fighting in France. They don't tell you that he's also one of the great historians of the First World War, but if you watch that, look for Paul Fussell. And this is also a great book, The Great War in Modern Memory. Periodically, the high command, with enthusiasm and optimism that never seemed to dim, ordered a general offensive in this or that sector of the front. These battles, though battles is not the best word, having been applied to what happened to imply that the war made sense in a traditional way, were preceded by an artillery barrage intended to flatten the enemy's wire, destroy his strong points, and leave his troops cowering in their trenches. When this preparation was complete, the infantry would go over the top of their trenches with fixed bayonets, and under a rolling barrage, walk toward the enemy trenches. All too often it was discovered at this point that the barrage had not done what it was expected to do. The enemy had withstood the barrage and now remanned its machine guns to mow down the oncoming troops. As a result, the gains were always infinitesimal and the losses colossal. During all of 1915, despite repeated attacks, the British and the French did not gain more than 3 miles at any one point. The French alone suffered 1,430,000 casualties. Verdun, the Germans hammered at Verdun for 10 months in 1916 and did not take it. The Germans lost 336,000 men. The French, 377,000 men, with no change. Now, it was at Verdun that the whole concept of the war of attrition was developed. And you may have heard that term. Well, it comes from Verdun, and this was the height of this sort of strategizing. Verdun was in this area where the Germans had broken through before, at Sedan, and it also stood in front of Champagne Country and on the direct line to Paris. And it had such symbolic value that the Germans knew the French would never give up there. They would never give up. They would pay any cost to stop the Germans from breaking through. But it also happened to be the hardest point in the line. When we say fortress in the 20th century, we mean fortress of like 12 little fortresses. I mean, it was a very hard port in the line with these fortresses on top of these hills. You would want to attack anywhere else but there if you had a sound mind. But the Germans said, look, they won't give up there. So we're going to attack there. And the goal is not to break through because it's impossible to break. But what we want to do is attack there, force the French to throw everything they have at us, and kill at a higher rate. So it's a rate of killing that's important. We think that we can kill at a 2-to-1 rate, and we will thereby bleed the French white at Verdun. Now, how do you get men to fight that way? You know you're not going to break through, but you tell them, fight with everything you've got and kill at a double rate. And then, well, you don't tell them. You tell them, intelligence says it's possible to break through at Verdun. So you send 500,000 men into that thing, and they get obliterated. And what happens? It's war. Plans don't work. They kill at a 1-to-1 rate. They kill at a 1-to-1 rate. And even the commander of the whole operation threw up his hands in disgust when he saw the intelligence report from before and realized that he had been conned into leading 500,000 German troops into an impossible mission. It was the Crown Prince. It was Wilhelm II's son. He had been the fall guy, and he resigned in disgust. And that happened. So Verdun is very symbolic of the whole hypocritical and vicious way that the war was being managed at the cost of, 700,000 men. In the same year occurred the Battle of the Somme, known by the soldiers who took part in it as the Great Fuck-Up. This was the largest engagement fought since the beginnings of civilization. The English bombarded the enemy trenches for a full week, firing 1.5 million shells from 1,537 guns. At 7:30 on the morning of July 1, the artillery shifted to more distant targets, and the attacking waves of 11 British divisions climbed out of their trenches on a 13-mile front and began walking forward. By 7:31, the mere 6 German divisions facing them had carried their machine guns upstairs from the deep dugouts where they had harbored safely and were hosing the attackers walking toward them in orderly rows or puzzling before the still uncut wire. Out of the 110,000 who attacked that morning, 60,000 were killed on this one day. Over 20,000 lay between the lines, and it was days before the wounded in no man's land stopped crying out. At the Somme, the Allies lost 614,000 men, and the Germans 650,000 men, with no gain on either side. No, that's the extended, right? So, I could give you more, but here's some totals. Now, this isn't to compare, but to put frame things. In Vietnam, and you know what that did to the United States, the Americans lost 58,000 dead, 153,000 wounded, and for a total of 210,000 casualties. Terrible. Viet Cong probably lost 1 million or maybe 2 million. It's fuzzy. Okay. So you're talking about 2.5 million, we'll say, casualties, official. Right. Terrible. World War I, 8,530,000 killed, 21,219,000 wounded, 7,750,000 missing. When I hear missing, I pretty much think, you know, probably dead. So you put those two together, it's about 16 million killed, for total casualties of 37,508,000. 37,508,000. Now, as soon as the war was over, European society was so decimated and weakened, an influenza whipped through, especially in Central Europe, and killed twice that many. 60 million died of the influenza after the war. But we can see that as a residual impact of the war itself. So, I mean, the First World War is stupendous. Stupendous. In terms of the specific destructive statistics, right? But also stupendous in terms of the, you know, the broader impact that it had on Western civilization and the Western mind and thought. And nowhere was that impact stronger than in Germany. Right? Germany was in the middle of it all the way, of course, fighting on two-front war the whole time. And in the end, it's Germany who's defeated. Remarkable that it held out against all those forces that long. A little, you know, of that military respect to them for having done so. But ultimately saddled with full responsibility and the requirement to pay reparations for the war, and the impact that it had on German society, right? The loss, the economic devastation, and the specific political ramifications of it. The First World War ends in a final sort of burst in an effort for glory on the part of the German leadership and high command. They put together what was known in 1917 and 1918 as the last offensive. They put in every resource they possibly had. Right? And they made one final push. Now, it was pretty well known by those who were on the ground this wasn't probably going to work. The Americans are in the war by this time. They've been cut off. They've been blockaded for 4 years. They just don't have the material or the manpower to do this. But they're going to go out with a blaze of glory. Now, I can say that some people didn't think they could do it, because this triggers a rebellion on the part of the Navy. The Navy had been blockaded for most of the war. Some of you may have seen Das Boot, which is an unbelievable movie about a submarine crew. Okay? Well, that's later, but you get a sense of how the life of these naval officers and Marines were was, and how intense it was for them. Well, they had been blockaded for the most part, but they were told, go, okay, break out and make this final effort. And the sailors said, no, we are not going. Right? We are revolting. And so they kill a couple of officers and take control of Kiel, which is a major naval installation. And that is the germ that triggers the German Revolution that will that will remove Wilhelm from power, ultimately. Well, that's taking place, but the land forces do invade. And they do break out of the trenches for a period, and they do push forward, and they do advance on France, and they do get to the second Marne. But their energy, their materiel, their manpower ran out, right? And they're stopped at the Second Battle of the Marne, and ultimately defeated. Now, meanwhile, the High Command and Wilhelm II have looked at this and said, "Well, that's it. We're out of here. Sorry." And Wilhelm flees to Holland with a number of his immediate of officers, so they run out of town, and I'm going to tell you more about this later. But the Social Democratic Party, which is trying to figure out whether it's going to follow this revolutionary plan or use the Reichstag and do things in a more liberal democratic way, or if they're going to have a communist model, you know, all of these tensions are going on. But they're left with having to negotiate peace. And they're forced to go into the negotiations in Versailles, and they're the ones that are handed this, what's known in Germany as the Diktat, the dictated peace. Not a negotiated peace, but a dictated peace. That's still known that way in Germany, the Diktat. They had no choice. And the Social Democrat foreign official who signs it says, the hand that signs this will wither away. But I have no choice. So they signed it. Okay. Now I'm telling you all this because the end game is going to have a tremendous amount of symbolic value within the culture of the First World War and its impact in Wilhelmine society. Working backward, that act of suing for peace, accepting the Versailles Treaty, is perceived by diehard patriots, diehard soldiers, and then this is transferred over to young kids whose fathers died and uncles died and brothers died and so forth, as a stab in the back. And it becomes this legend, we might call it an urban legend in Germany, that that the German forces were advancing in the last offensive. And maybe they had a chance to break through, and it seemed like they were going to go through, but suddenly the leftist Jewish conspiracy reared its head in the back in the form of these revolutionary elements in the Navy and revolutionary elements in Berlin. And they, you know, take things out of chronology, and they leave out the fact that Wilhelm had left and all of those things, and they just strip it down to this Jewish socialist democratic conspiracy went into action, stabbed our troops in the back, right, just as they were on the verge of victory, right? And they're known as the November criminals. The November criminals, because the German Revolution takes place in November of 1918. Okay, so the November criminals stabbed German tradition, the German military greatness, in the back and killed it. So that's the first key element in the mythology of the First World War. We could have won it. We could have won it. And right-wing politicians will build on that. And I'm not even going to try to come up with an analogy now. But like 9/11. It's useful. Okay? It's that powerful to throw that card out there. The First World War and its end. Now, the other key element in the idea of the First World War that has so much resonance in the interwar period is that of war enthusiasm in 1914. So going back to the beginning of it, the end and the beginning. When the tensions of between Austria-Hungary, Serbia, Germany, Russia, and so on, unfolded in the summer of 1914, late summer of 1914. You know, everybody was watching this. I mean, it was even more exciting than football, right? I mean, everybody was into this, and everybody was following every moment, and Europeans were paying attention to this. There had been a couple of near misses over the last decade, and so there was some anticipation that war could result. And when the mobilizations were ordered in the capitals of Europe in 1914, hundreds of thousands of people in the cities went out into the streets, okay, and ostensibly were enthusiastic about the potential of going to war. This happened in London, and it happened in Paris, and it happened in Germany, and it happened in, well, I don't know about Russia, Austria. And there were photographs to show it, and there were just people out there who seemed to symbolize this willingness and eagerness to go to war. Now, some historians have gone through that and looked at day-to-day reports and studied the newspapers and so on and said, well, probably, in fact, these people were milling around wondering what was going on. It wasn't like they're all just chomping at the bit. Okay, that's historical truth. It's probably a little fuzzier. But the myth is that they were really ready to go to war. And that everybody was excited about it, everybody was enthusiastic about it, and willing to put aside any differences that they had politically, socially, racially, whatever, in order to have a common effort to win the war. Right? And Wilhelm II cashed in on that right away, because his main speech is, I only see one Germany. I don't see Germanys, I just see one Germany. We are unified, we are a united state now in this effort. Well, what that translated into was, you better get in line, right, or you're going to end up in jail or censored or whatever else, which is what happened to any anti-war resistors and any leftists who didn't see this as being in the interest of the working class, right? So people like Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg end up thrown in jail for most of the war if they said anything about humanity and not killing each other for 4 years, okay? But it was justified in terms of this war enthusiasm. Can you see the people wanted to fight? And the other manifestations of that become legendary are tales of young students signing up en masse, whole classes of schools, gymnasium, going from the gymnasium, walking down, signing up, going through training together very quickly, getting out into the field, and then marching and charging in the early stages of the mobile battle while singing patriotic songs. So there's this whole set of symbols derived from the first stages of the war that are central to the whole idea of the war as a whole and will influence German politics throughout. Now, I'm setting these things up because we're going to look for indications of how Remarque was dealing with these issues at the within his description of it. Now, another is that in the war, characters were built. Characters were built. And this manifested itself in a couple of ways. One, in this intense sense of camaraderie among soldiers, that men bond in combat like they can't bond anywhere else. And that bond is stronger and more intense than any other political association or even sense of nationalism or patriotism. You have more in common with a fellow soldier who's been in combat than you have with anyone else. And you'll fight for that fellow soldier or for that fellow band of brothers, regardless of what else is going on. You know, if you have to fight your own soldiers, you'll fight them for these 15. right? So if you, and if you watch Ken Burns, for instance, you'll see a lot of elements of the 442nd. Each of these divisions and regiments and so on, they have their own identity. They build up around their, perhaps their general, but more importantly, their fellow soldiers. And the HBO series Band of Brothers gives you a sense of that intensity with which that takes place. So that's the camaraderie of soldiering. The other is that leadership principle, that out of action in combat, certain individuals will rise up and be able to handle and stay calm and make decisions in battle, and others will just latch onto them. And it doesn't matter what their rank is, and it doesn't matter what their heritage is. Okay, it may be an officer, but it might be a corporal. It may be another private, and something you may be familiar with. But I think at in the Operation Overlord, and I'm trying to think of which beach, at Omaha Beach, you know, the Americans were held down, and no one knows exactly who it was for sure. But somebody, they're pinned down, you know, most of the morning, and they weren't going anywhere, and somebody said, "God damn it, we have to get off this beach." And that guy ran up there with one of these pipes and, you know, basically just said, "I'm just sick of being here," and throws this pipe up there, and they're able to shove some grenades up there and blow through the first, that's the first act of somebody saying, "God damn it, we're just going." Right? And some private, he wasn't ordered to do it. It wasn't an officer. It was just somebody who had the guts to say, "Okay, let's go." And they put that first explosion up there, and they blew out some of the, and then they started to push up that hole, and that's how they started to ferret their way out. Okay, so that's the kind of legend of just your average soldier taking control. And this gets transformed to a whole notion of a leadership principle that's out of action like that, that some people will rise up and become stronger. And the example of that in the book is Kat, right? Kat, this guy who just knows where the food is. If he's not a ranking officer, but if you're going to go into battle, you want to figure out where Kat is, because Kat has this second sense as to how to survive and how to perform and so forth. Okay, so you have the stab in the back, you have the enthusiasm, the camaraderie, the leadership principle, the value of combat experience. These are all elements that will really feed into interwar cultural representations of the war, and become core to how the war is incorporated into German society as a whole. And it's around those issues that, to a certain extent, Weimar politics will struggle. The left is going to have trouble with these. The left is going to have trouble with them. They're not going to incorporate these myths of the war experiences that well. Okay. And the right is going to just feed on them. It's going to feed on them. You know, we need to pick up that enthusiasm again. We need to strengthen ourselves through combat. We need to build bonds of brotherhood such as are formed in war, right? And we need to look for leaders who will rise out of circumstances this way. And this all becomes part of the ranting and the raving of the German right. Meanwhile, the left is presenting much more critical views of what takes place in the war, and I think we would say honest views of what took place in the war. That it brutalized individuals, humanity, and culture as a whole. That people were dehumanized in the war. That they were rendered, you know, cogs in a machine initially, just as Dietrich likes to be, and then we can see that the military system constructs them. But then in the war, in this mass war of millions, of hundreds of thousands of losses in a particular afternoon, right, and millions over time, it's completely depersonalized, and this is a negative effect not just on the veterans, but on society as a whole. This is where, you know, people really lose their individuality in the modern world and become absolutely valueless irrelevant. So the capacity to kill, and or to think of opponents as subject to extermination or elimination, you eradicate your enemies. Okay, that may have been part of the language before the war, but the war gave you an experience of actually doing that. Okay, so it brutalizes Western civilization as a whole, but particularly German culture, and that'll play itself out. And we want to see how the roots of it exist in the war. Then, of course, there are simply the horrors of the war. The clash between machines and man, and the dimensions of the killing, and the absurd quality of the deaths. Of course, when shells hit bodies in the Napoleonic Wars, or in the Franco-Prussian Wars, I mean, it was horrible. I mean, a cannonball hits your head and your head blows back. I mean, that happens universally. But for millions of people to see millions of other people dying, though, it's the proportions of it has this numbing effect, and seems to confirm, you know, the worst nightmares that modernists had about the capacity for men to act bestially toward others, right? But it also confirms pre-war notions or exaggerations, really, of what the impact of machinery and will have on life and industry, because the industrialization of war, starting with train travel, which made it possible to get all these men and material into one place so quickly, so that they were blasting at each other these way, machine guns, tanks, high-speed artillery, and by that, what that means is the shell gets there really fast. Okay, you have no warning when you're getting fired on by faster and faster rates. And if you watch the Ken Burns, the Americans are always talking about the German 88s, and that was this cannon that could fire a shell that was just kaboom, and there was no, you can't hear the thing whizzing at you. You don't have any anticipation of it, so you're sitting there, whatever you're doing, and it's just that fast. You know, there's no warning. So when they hear that 88th firing, that's what they're talking about. Because the Germans, that's in the Second World War, but that just gives you an idea that speeding up in the First World War. So technology and questioning technology. Now, another tremendous conceptual element to the experience of the First World War was a sense of being surrounded by at least two enemies. Now, for the German case, this makes sense, because they were, right? They're trapped by enemies on either side, right? But all front soldiers felt this to a certain degree, that they were fighting the enemy before them, obviously, right? But they're also the victims of an enemy behind them. And that took two forms. One were these high commands that kept sending them to do impossible things, or ridiculous things, fathomable things, right? And I know more, for whatever reason, I know more anecdotes, but I mean, there are anecdotes of British officers in the high command driving up to the front for the first time and only time, right? And just freaking out, because they had no idea what it was they had been sending men up into. The smell, the mud, and then the actual gore and devastation just blew their minds, right? And they went back and hid in the back, because they had never seen it. They'd just been pins on a piece of paper up to that point. So there was no connection between the high command and the soldiers and what was going on up there. And so the soldiers feel that it's us against them and against them. And the other manifestation of that was the home front. And that's important, of course, in Remarque's presentation of this. If they did get home for leave, they just felt completely disconnected, right, as veterans. They had no way to communicate to the people at home what it was that was going on out there. How can words describe what they've been going through? And of course, veterans have this problem, you know, always have this problem, right? And this is the source of a lot of trauma and post-traumatic stress syndrome and so on and so forth, right? But in the First World War, they didn't have fancy words for that. And you'd just come back, and these guys would try to say maybe a little bit about what was going on, but it was, how did they tell their moms what it was like to be out there? How did they tell the mom of a friend how their friend really died? Right? They just can't do it, so they block up. Okay. So that's the whole concept of the home front versus the front. Now, these are all elements that, as I've said, really play into the culture of the First World War, not just in Germany, but particularly in Germany, if we say that's our focus. And Remarks, All Quiet on the Western Front, is an excellent introduction to most of these. Now, a little bit on Remarque himself and the book. What do we have? Is that thing? Are we over?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, let me just say really quickly. This book was not written immediately during the war, and it wasn't written immediately after the war. It wasn't written until 1929. And Remarque was opposed to this right-wing version of the war that I've talked about. So, let me just say, look for these themes that I've talked to you about, including those of strength through battle and camaraderie and leadership principle and so on. He incorporates those because they're so much part of the war legend, right? But his book was perceived as having been written to counter those, to present a critical view of the war and to, you know, highlight the destructive and depersonalizing and the dehumanization of people, right? As an anti-war book. Now, for that reason, this book was tremendously controversial. The Nazis went berserk when it came out. The Nazis went even crazier when it came out as a well-done movie, which you can actually rent and see to this day. It's worth watching even now. They went insane, and they picketed it, and they demonstrated against it. This is in 1930, so 3 years before they came to power, and it was a lightning rod for them, and they got a lot of press out of that at a time when they really weren't that big a player. Keep these things in mind. Look to see how Remarque has incorporated these things into his narrative. And we'll talk about, you know, the fact that they're there and how it both represents the importance of those values in right-wing German culture to the point where he had to include them, but also the way he presented them. Can we see that it was a critical standpoint, and did he contribute in some way to a debunking of those myths of the war? Okay?